I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. A week after the U.S. Senate released a sharply critical report on the intelligence used to go to war in Iraq, Britain's Lord Butler issued his long-awaited report this morning. It is the fourth official inquiry in Britain into how Prime Minister Tony Blair and others built the case for war. WBUR's Michael Goldfarb is on the line from London. And Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gail.
As you know, the Senate intelligence report in this country was very critical of the intelligence agencies. Was the Butler report as tough on British intelligence?
Oh, no, no. You remember last week when the Senate report came out, the CIA was pinned with the most catastrophic failure in its history and so on, that kind of language. Here it was much more mild, although Lord Butler said that the intelligence presented in the now infamous dossier of September 2002 was seriously flawed. He said that almost all the intelligence from British intelligence services had been presented to the government with the proper caveats and cautions and qualifications. Mm-hmm. And he added that his brief was only to look at the performance of British intelligence services and would not comment on the other intelligence services involved in putting together information on Saddam and possible weapons of mass destruction. The most interesting criticism in the whole piece was the criticism of the presentation of intelligence to the public by the government. And here he said that the intelligence had been stretched to the outer limits of its meaning. And although he made no personal criticisms of anyone, it was clear that that was aimed at the top of the government. And after Lord Butler presented his findings, Tony Blair went into the House of Commons to make a statement on Lord Butler's report and took full responsibility for the way the intelligence was presented to the public as the government tried to build its case for war.
And in fact, when Blair appeared in Parliament, there was a really raucous exchange between him and the Conservative Party leader, Michael Howard. Howard had asked what would happen the next time Blair asked his country to go to war and offered intelligence to make his case.
The issue is the Prime Minister's credibility. The question he must ask himself is, does he have any credibility left?
Well, let me first of all just deal with the issue of good faith. Because I knew that what the right honourable gentleman would have to do, since, of course, he supported the war.
Yeah.
Supports it still. Indeed, let me just read out for the House what was said. Oh, on the basis of what I said. Oh, is that the reason? Well, let's just look at that for a moment, shall we? Here was the right honourable gentleman duped into supporting the war by me, was it?
Well, and then Blair goes on to quote Howard's own words. Let's listen to a little more of that.
I managed to get hold of a copy of his speech to the Murdoch Corporation. This is what he said when addressing them. The war against Iraq was necessary, it was just, it was indeed arguably overdue.
Well, some pretty tough language there, Michael, in the relatively few seconds we have left. What do you make of it, and how's this going to affect Tony Blair's hold on power?
Well, you know, Gail, at this point in this process, this is the fourth of these investigations. I think people in this country have long ago made up their minds one way or another about whether they were duped to go into war and whether they're going to make the prime minister pay a political price for that. I don't think this is going to have a big effect. But later this week, there will be two by-elections in this country to fill empty seats in Parliament in what are traditionally Labour Party seats. If the Labour Party loses them, I think you'll have an indication of the kind of price the prime minister may have to pay in the future.
All right, Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb in London. Thanks, Michael. The Associated Press is reporting that the Iraqi Interior Ministry is saying insurgents have killed the governor of the northern city of Mosul. This came just hours after a suicide car bomber blew himself up at the gates of the American-controlled Green Zone in central Baghdad. At least 11 people died and dozens more were injured in that blast. It was the deadliest attack in the capital since Iraq's interim government took over on June 28th. Newsweek reporter Christopher Dickey is in Baghdad and joins us now with the latest. Christopher, what else can you tell us about the bombing?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that the explosion took place at the gate that's most often used by members of this new interim government. It used to be the gate used by people in the governing council, and that's what we called it. So I think that they probably see it as an attempt to go after them even more than an attempt to go after the Americans or other members of the coalition. And I think that's probably the most important thing about this.
Certainly a disheartening development, though, for people who were just beginning to hope that perhaps things were going to be quiet for a while.
Well, that's right, although, you know, people have gotten very fatalistic here. I arrived in Baghdad just a few days ago, but it's been very, very impressive, the change since the last time I was here a couple of months ago. The extent that to which you have police just all over the street, stopping cars, searching their trunks, looking underneath them. So it's interesting and a little bit disconcerting that a bomb this big could get that close to the government buildings in the Green Zone. But on the other hand, I think people here feel that the priorities have changed under this new government, and there is a focus on making Baghdad safe, interestingly enough, in a way that there was not under the previous setup with the Coalition Provisional Authority attempting to run the country.
And today was also a government holiday. All the offices were closed, which presumably minimized the casualties. Do you see that as deliberate, perhaps a warning of what these groups could still do, as opposed to an attempt to cause as much damage as possible?
No, I think that these groups will cause as much damage as possible when they can. They may have thought that because it was a national holiday, security would be more lax and they could get closer that way, that the checkpoints wouldn't be manned as rigorously as they are normally. And in the event, there were a lot of Iraqis standing in line at the main entrance, checkpoint 3, that's used by the public, and that's close enough so that a lot of them were injured quite seriously.
And perhaps we should also mention that the government holiday was the 46th anniversary of the coup that killed Iraq's last king, Faisal II.
Well, that's right. That was a very bloody coup that ended the monarchy. It's interesting that it's still being celebrated under this new government.
Now, the new Iraqi prime minister has said that this might have been a response to the roundup of suspected terrorists and criminals in the last few days. Is that what you're hearing as well?
That's a politician talking. He's saying it's because of what we're doing, not it's because of the failure of what we're doing. Obviously, if the roundups were successful, that bomb wouldn't have gotten anywhere near the Green Zone. In fact, it would never have been produced and it would never have detonated. This is simply an ongoing effort by the insurgents to attack the regime, to undermine the American presence here, and to attack symbols of the American presence here.
And Christopher, what happens after an attack like this? How does the government go about investigating who was responsible?
Well, they round up the usual suspects. One of the things that the Alawi government has been doing the last 2 weeks is rounding up an unusually large number of the usual suspects. They also sometimes have forensic evidence. Sometimes there's a signature of the bomb. But they haven't really had a very good record of finding the specific bombers in these cases.
Christopher, thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
Christopher Dickey is a reporter for Newsweek. He joined us from Baghdad. A Filipino truck driver threatened with death by Iraqi militants is reported to be safe now. Without giving any details, a Philippine foreign ministry official says Angela de la Cruz is out of danger. As it's part of the deal, the Philippine government has begun withdrawing its troops from Iraq ahead of schedule. But the killing of other hostages is continuing. Militants in Iraq say they beheaded a Bulgarian truck driver yesterday, and they're threatening to murder another Bulgarian within 24 hours. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow and specialist in international security at the Brookings Institution. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
How do you interpret what can only be seen, I would imagine, as a concession?
I think you're right, and obviously this is going to concern people in Washington and elsewhere greatly because, obviously, to the extent that this tactic works, people will be even more encouraged to try it in the future. If there's no silver lining here, of course, but if there's anything that mitigates the damage a little bit, perhaps, it's that we've seen these beheadings and hostage takings continue even when countries have not given in. And so perhaps there is not as much of a rationality to the terrorist actions as we might have thought, or at least they don't have a short-term expectation of being able to drive people out of the coalition. They have more of a general strategy of just trying to wear down people's will. And so they would have continued this sort of thing anyway, whether the Philippines made this concession or not. I guess that's the more positive way to look at it. But it's obviously not good news, and it will, on the margin at least, encourage people to do even more of this.
Well, exactly. As you say, that has been the conventional wisdom. Is there any reason to believe that the conventional wisdom no longer applies?
No, I don't think that there is. I think that the main broad trend that's potentially working to our advantage here is, of course, the transfer of sovereignty and the fact that Mr. Alawi, the prime minister, is targeting this group of Iraqis, what I often call a third group, not the Baathists and not the terrorists or foreign jihadists, but normal Iraqis who were upset with the occupation and picked up arms to fire against Americans, but don't necessarily have any enduring interest in causing violence. We can hope that that trend is stronger than any of the others that are now being witnessed with these hostage takings and beheadings and other such acts and their threats to the coalition. But in terms of what this is going to do to the coalition, this kind of development is bad. There's just no other way to spin it.
And Michael, do we know at this point how many of these various terrorist groups are taking hostages? Is it few? Is it most of them? Is it all of them?
I don't think we even know who the terrorist groups are in Iraq and exactly how many they number and who's the strongest and how closely tied they are to each other. One of the most interesting pieces of reporting in the last week that I've seen out of Iraq was by an Associated Press reporter named Jim Crane, who talked to American intelligence and military intelligence officials, and they told him that the resistance may number 20,000 people, which is four times the number we had ever heard from an American government official prior to that interview. And that tells you how little we know, that we are potentially off by at least a factor of four. It might have been 5,000, it might have been 20,000, it might be something in between, it may be even more than 20,000 people in this resistance. So if we have no sense of how many people are part of it, we also probably don't know how many groups are part of it or how closely they work with each other.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you very much.
American consumers are watching what they buy. Numbers from the Commerce Department today indicate that sales at the nation's retailers last month dropped 1.1%. That was the largest drop in 16 months. The buying retreat came after a shopping spree in May. So what caused June's decline? Economists offer a number of explanations. Bad weather, high gas prices. Another possible reason could be a slowdown in the number of new jobs last month. Consumers stayed away from buying cars and clothes, but it was a good month for sales of furniture, building and garden supplies, and sporting goods. Shoppers, as always, play an important role in the economy. Consumer spending accounts for roughly two-thirds of all economic activity. Economists do see a silver lining, though. Many predict that spending will be back on track this month and into the back-to-school months of August and September. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. The ideal college experience for some might be 4 years of nothing but video games. Well, now a new program is attempting to take gaming officially off the couch and into the classroom. Starting this fall, Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, is offering a degree program in electronic games. Joining us in the studio is Champlain College Program Director Anne DeMarle. Anne, welcome.
Hello.
What's the curriculum? What do these students actually study?
Quite a bit, actually. It's a degree that has two different tracks that the students can decide to enter into. And I like to say it can be, if you're a writer, there is one track for you. If you're an artist, there's another track for you. Either you come out as a 3D animator and artist for games and also for film, or you come out as a game designer who is the strategist, the writer, the person who invents the characters, who makes it more difficult as you move along the game. It draws on a lot of different disciplines. They have to take, for instance, cognitive psychology. They have to take introduction to computers, different programming languages, graphic programs, English, of course, history.
So clearly not the modern version of basket weaving.
No, I hope not.
And are you actually the first to offer this as a degree-granting program?
We are the first, definitely in New England area, to offer a bachelor's degree in it.
How likely is it that your students are going to be able to find jobs?
The market itself, the industry itself, has been growing at about 15 to 20% in the last 5 years. The need for employees is really large. You can attend a conference or you can go online and you see they're advertising all over the place. Part of it is because the skill level is high. An entry-level person could be a game tester, which is, you know, you'd got to enjoy playing games and finding things that are wrong with it and be able to master spreadsheets and stuff like that. But at the higher end, and you know, it needs a really knowledgeable base and someone who has skills, technical and creative, to enter into a field like that. So it's an industry really hungry for those kind of people right now.
And are there people who are hungry for this knowledge? Do you have people lining up who say, yes, I want a degree in e-gaming?
Yes, so far we do. Since we've just announced the degree itself, it's been overwhelming.
Well, good luck, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Anne DeMarl is Program Director for Champlain College's new e-gaming degree. Well, time spent playing video games often flies by, and it's that kind of distraction that students at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology hope to use to make time on an exercise machine less tedious. They're developing a new machine called CycleScore. It's an exercise bike hooked up to a video game. As you shoot targets and fight to get your hot air balloon over a mountain, the game rewards your virtual performance by relaxing resistance or increasing it. Here and Now's Lindsay Crudell spoke with Joe Heitzeberg about his creation.
So CycleScore takes ordinary exercise bikes that you find at most gyms, like treadmills and bikes and ellipticals, hooks them up to a computer experience that is designed to motivate and engage you, in effect to take your mind off of the fact that you're exercising.
So you really feel like as you're riding this bike, you can be completely unaware of what's happening to your body.
No, we're not exactly that far, but the spirit is a step in that direction. And have you ever played Tetris? You know that Tetris totally engages you, and it's not a game that's full of pictures and sounds and 3D or anything like that. So, but it's a very simple experience, and somehow it grabs a part of your mind. So we wanted to work to identify what were the characteristics of games like that, and then also of sports. You know, the fact that you're on the basketball court running back and forth, and somehow you're not thinking about counting calories, you're not thinking about going over a hill, right? And you're getting a great workout. So we thought of, what are the real reasons? Well, you're with friends. There's a social community aspect. There's skill building. You know, there's achievement. You're scoring points, right? And so we wanted to capture what are those things, and then if we can use those in a game, but channel it through the exercise itself, then you've created something where you are doing that.
What do we have here?
So this is CycleScore. What you have is basically a regular exercise bike hooked up to a TV screen, a big screen TV with has a computer in the background. So basically, the first time you use it, you have to calibrate. So you're just asked to pedal at an even pace for about a minute, and it kind of gives you some trivia and some interesting stuff to look at while you do it. And it's just trying to sense how in shape you are in a way, and then it'll kind of help you set the resistance.
It says, you are a balloon floating along a picturesque mountain scene. Your goal is to gain as many points as you can and to complete your workout. Score points by avoiding mountains, collecting coins, and shooting as many targets as you can. Pedal faster to lift your balloon over the mountains.
We put a button on the handlebar, so that's how you can aim and shoot.
That's usually where you get your heart rate read.
Yeah, and you're still getting your heart rate also. So the targets is something that I can shoot at. And if I hit a target further away, then I'm going to get more points, but it takes more skill to do that. Okay, coming up on a mountain now, so I got to pedal. Hold on a second. Okay, I made it. Whew. There we go, got 100 points. Hit a target.
Has your mind separated from your body yet?
Not quite.
Oh, get me away, I'm dying. 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 Oh.
Our visit to Cycle Score was produced by Here and Now's Lindsay Crudell. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and the town you're from. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we look at how police and security officials in Boston are getting ready for this month's Democratic convention. And is that red snapper you had for dinner really red snapper? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge is in Boston today to check on security preparations for the upcoming Democratic National Convention, now less than 2 weeks away. Joining us on the line from the Fleet Center in Boston is WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Gail. We're about to leave the Fleet Center.
And can you tell us what you've been doing so far? What is Tom Ridge looking for here, and what has he seen?
As soon as Tom Ridge arrived at Logan Airport this morning, he was taken to a location where all the federal security operations will be coordinated, somewhere in the Boston area. We're not allowed to tell you exactly where that is. He was greeted there by Mayor Tom Menino, and he was given a classified briefing. We were allowed to hear 5 minutes of the briefing that were not classified, where he basically received a briefing from the Federal Emergency Management Administration about where they would deploy their resources in case there was a major attack with weapons of mass destruction on Boston. From there, he went to the Fleet Center, which we are leaving now, and he was shown the floor of the convention floor there. We were not allowed to go in there because the Democratic National Convention Committee did not want us to see the floor at this point, because they're just not ready yet to unveil it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was shown an X-ray machine outside the Fleet Center, where all trucks entering the Fleet Center will have to go through. That machine will detect anything that might seem anomalous, and then from there, police will search trucks if they do detect anything.
Well, Fred, in the very few seconds we have left, let me just ask you: you say you're leaving the Fleet Center. Where are you on your way to?
We are headed for Charlestown. Part of the tour of Boston today will include a look at the port facilities in Boston, we understand.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Boston officials are moving ahead with preparations to deal with as many as 20,000 protesters expected to be in the city during the DNC. So far, 67 permits for demonstrations have been issued. Groups from all over the country have applied for permits to rally, march, hold vigils, and perform street theater in the city. And planning for these events is proving to be a major challenge for both the city and the protesters. WBUR's Rachel Gottbaum reports.
Are there any other changes or updates on the calendar? that people know about? Like, for instance, I wanted to ask you from the...
In the basement of the Polis Center in downtown Boston, a dozen people of all ages, some wearing business suits, others in T-shirts with multiple piercings, are sitting around tables. They're here from the American Civil Liberties Union, the Socialist Party, the Kucinich campaign, and other groups who have applied for permits to hold demonstrations during the Democratic National Convention.
On Monday at noon, from noon to one, there's Boston Police Patrolmen's Association has a permit. And so they will be, assuming they haven't settled a contract, they will be there till 1:30. And then we'll start it.
The demonstrators' agendas and messages vary from anti-war to anti-abortion to anti-government.
My name is Matthew Andrews, and I'm with the Socialist Party USA. I'm here to promote the events that we're organizing, which includes Dump the Democrats March on Monday, the first day of the Democratic National Convention, July 26th. And one of the other things that we're organizing is a one-person play called Marx in Soho.
I'm Jocelyn Berger, and I'm an intern with the American Friends Service Committee. I'm coordinating a traveling exhibit on the cost of war called Eyes Wide Open that features an ever-growing number, unfortunately, of combat boots commemorating the American soldiers killed. So right now we're around 825 pairs of boots.
Though the Republican National Convention in New York is expected to attract thousands more protesters than the Democratic Convention in Boston, Leslie Kagan, who came up from New York and is with United with Justice for Peace, says organizing demonstrators for the Republican convention is a lot simpler.
It's almost too easy in New York. We're very clearly going to be saying that we reject the whole Bush agenda, the whole Republican Party agenda. Here in Boston, the message is more complicated. There are many, many different points of view about how you support the Democrats. Do you support the Democrats? How do you challenge them? Do you challenge them?
Jesus was not condemned by the power of wicked people. He was condemned because of the silence of good people. Silence.
As they do every Friday morning, members of Operation Rescue hold a vigil in front of a women's health clinic in Brookline.
Let us pray that we never be silent about abortion, but we'll rather clearly speak up to save babies from death.
Operation Rescue is planning several events for the DNC. Bill Cotter is president of the Boston chapter.
We're going to be at John Kerry's church Sunday morning. There is an evening vigil planned in Lewisburg Square, an all-women's prayer vigil. And we'll also be in the vicinity of the Fleet Center trying to have some kind of pro-life presence, some type of highly visible message.
In May, the anti-abortion group sued the city for holding up the issuing of permits for the DNC. Boston officials relented and expedited the process. But even with the convention just a few weeks away, demonstrators and their lawyers are still wrangling with city officials over access to turf. Patricia Malone, director of the Mayor's Office of Consumer Affairs and Licensing, says Boston has never had to deal with so many different demonstrations at one time.
The volumes of people that are coming into the city, coupled with the demonstrations and the protests that are going on, coupled with, you know, national security and kind of the whole area around the Fleet Center, as well as people coming into the city so they can't come into the city and do their jobs, as well as people who want to be in different areas to rally and protest and have it all go on safely at the same time. So it's a juggling act.
The city has set up what is called a free speech zone near the Fleet Center. The space, which can hold up to 4,000 people, has just been cleared of rubble, and officials say it will be ready in time for the convention. But many demonstrators are holding events in large public spaces, like the Boston Common and Copley Square. One of the largest is the Black Tea Society, a local anarchist group which was created in response to the convention, says activist Ellie Gillette.
Inside that convention, the walls are going to be black. You're not going to be able to see in. They're putting a fence up that's opaque that you will not be able to see through. Democracy doesn't exist behind those walls. I can't go behind those walls, and I don't have a voice at that table. The voices of the people are going to be outside that convention.
Both city officials and civil libertarians say with the large number of people expected to come to Boston to demonstrate during the Democratic convention, no amount of planning can prevent the possibility of conflict with the police, arrests, or rioting.
Our report was prepared by WBUR's Rachel Gottbaum. Here and Now's coverage of the upcoming Democratic National Convention continues tomorrow with a look at how Boston police are training to handle the protesters.
It's best to go into a situation, you know, police officers in ordinary uniforms, assuming best case scenario, maintaining order, trying to be helpful to the crowds, And then, of course, you have to have equipment and tactically trained people close by in the event that an incident goes bad.
That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Should medical students be allowed to do pelvic exams on anesthetized women without their consent? The practice has been common at teaching hospitals around the country, but that may be changing. Here and Now's Alan Cockle spoke with health columnist Judy Foreman and asked her about the controversy.
It's been the practice at many medical schools to have medical students, who, after all, are there to learn, do a pelvic exam on a woman after she's unconscious but before the surgery begins.
So the exam is something that's necessary for the surgical procedure?
That's right. It's necessary for the surgeon to do it before the procedure. The medical students are there to learn about it.
Well, how common is this?
No one knows exactly. There are no real statistics, but one study suggested that 90% of medical students had done these exams on anesthetized women. It was not clear from that study how many of those had given permission or not.
It's surprising in this age of legal protections and informed consent that it's still happening. What kind of reaction do you get from women when you tell them that this goes on?
Oh, women are appalled. Doctors and hospitals sort of have a different view. To them, it's so common. This is how you teach medical students, and they justify it by saying, well, if a patient goes to a teaching hospital, they must know that the students are there. They're going to participate in the care. They're there to learn. A lot of hospitals have consent forms that say you have to acknowledge that a medical student may be participating in your care.
Right. And, I mean, isn't that valid? What's the problem?
The catch is that I think people understand that medical students may be there watching, but the sort of ethical dilemma is right on the word care versus education. Medical students really don't participate in your care. They don't do anything that's of real benefit to the patient. They are there to learn for themselves and for future patients.
You mentioned this study last year, which was sort of the first study to really expose how widespread this practice was. What was the reaction after that study was published?
Oh, a lot of schools seem to have changed their policies. I mean, it's been embarrassing for a lot of medical schools. Harvard had already changed its policy 6 or 7 years ago because a bunch of medical students protested to the dean, saying they felt uncomfortable doing this. But a number of other schools have changed since this study came out last year, and they're tightening up the policies. And basically, all they really have to do is ask permission and make it clear that patients have to give permission for this.
Why don't they ask consent?
Sometimes they think they're already covered, that patients know that they're going to a teaching hospital and that's enough. But the more sort of sinister explanation is they're afraid patients will say no, which of course makes it ethically even dicier if they're doing it without permission, or they don't want to take the time, or they don't want to get into that back and forth with patients.
The other thing that this study finds, which may be surprising and concerning, is that the further medical trainees get into their training, the less likely they are to ask consent or the less concerned they are about the absence of consent.
That's exactly right. And that really is troubling because they sort of get very blasé about whether they need to ask permission. It's almost as if they feel like they have a right to the patient's body. And that's kind of one of those subtle cultural changes that happens in people over the course of medical school.
Where do you think the profession is now? Is it becoming more aware of issues like consent, or is this still overall a problem?
Public embarrassment by this study and sort of the issue coming to the fore has sort of forced medical schools to be more explicit about how they ask for consent and that they should ask for consent. There's one other piece of this, too, which is that for a number of years, there have been women willing to be paid volunteers for doctors to practice pelvic exams on. And so there's actually not that huge a need to practice on anesthetized patients.
Judy Foreman, our regular health columnist. To read her latest, go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. At the International AIDS Conference in Bangkok today, U.S. efforts against the disease are continuing to come in for criticism from the rest of the world. U.S. AIDS Coordinator Randall Tobias says the United States is spending more to fight AIDS than any other country. Well, joining us on the line from Bangkok is Boston Globe reporter John Donnelly, who's been covering the conference. John, welcome. And let's talk about some of this criticism. It seems to be coming from all sides, from UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, French President Jacques Chirac. What's their quarrel with U.S. AIDS policy?
Well, I think they're mostly upset that the U.S. seems to be taking a go-it-alone policy. And you have to remember that I think especially with Kofi Annan, that he, like many people here in Bangkok, are just very frustrated at this moment that there isn't more swifter advances being made, especially in extending treatment to more people. The U.S. is requiring that now all drugs that it buys, it will have to test itself to make sure that the drugs are high quality. And they're also deciding to not buy condoms for all populations. They're just restricting those to high-risk groups, and by that they mean sex workers or men who are very mobile, you know, truck drivers, for instance.
John, you write today about South Africa's decision to stop using the drug nevirapine for women in labor. It's used to prevent the transmission of AIDS to their babies. So why stop using it, and what kind of impact might this decision have on other African countries?
Well, South Africa decided to stop actually recommending its use in South Africa because of the resistance that develops with women who then go on their own treatment. The problem with this, though, and most people here, most experts here say, is that the effect of it will be that other African countries now will also decide to opt out of nevirapine, and that indeed many women in South Africa also will say, well, our government says it's not good enough. Why should we take it? Is there a danger to it? Nevirapine is a great drug for many reasons. It's just a simple single dose given right during childbirth, and it adds another 50% of protection from the passing of the virus from mother to child.
John, you've now been at this conference all week, and your regular beat is Africa, where, of course, AIDS has taken a terrible toll. What do you see coming out of this conference?
2 years ago in Barcelona, there were about 200,000, maybe 150,000 people on treatment. And then the big call was, we need to ramp this up quickly. We're getting the money now. We're finally can move ahead. And 2 years later, there are 440,000 people on treatment, and with an estimated 6 million who need treatment. So people here are saying, why aren't we working in a much more efficient way? And I think there's still some hope that some things can work better. But it's a very frustrating moment, I would say.
Well, John, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Boston Globe reporter John Donnelly spoke to us from Bangkok, Thailand. The AIDS rate among African-American women in the United States is 3 times higher than that of Latina women and 18 times higher than that for white women. While those statistics are shocking on their own, what is perhaps even more surprising is that 75% of HIV-infected black women are getting the virus through heterosexual sex. AIDS educator and author J.L. King thinks he knows why. The reason, he says, is called the down low, a trend in which straight black men, many of them married, have sex with other black men. And according to King, few of these men use condoms, and fewer call themselves gay. The down low, says King, is creating one of the country's most serious threats to public health. His new book, On the Down Low, provides a firsthand look at the down low and its impact on black America. J.L., welcome.
Good afternoon.
Tell us first, how prevalent is the down low, and how do you know about it?
First of all, I'm always asked to quantitate the numbers so people can have a good idea of how many men we're talking about. And it's hard to do that because you're talking about an invisible population. If I interviewed personally over 2,500 African-American men who would be considered DL or on a down low, out of those 2,500, the youngest was 18, the oldest 78. I know about it because I am a former down low individual.
And why is it that men on the down low are so much less likely to use condoms and to practice safe sex?
because it makes them think about what they're doing. Down low basically means bisexuality. Bisexuality that's not really revealed or discussed with anyone. When you're on the down low, you just don't talk about your sexual desires with anyone, even when you're asked by your girlfriend, your wife, or family members, or even your best friends. You deny it. Part of being on the down low is to cover up your tracks by all means necessary. That's why you have a lot of down low men who will verbally bash homosexuality, the gay culture, and gay men because they cannot allow anyone to even think that they are participating in the same type of behavior.
One of the points you make in the book is about how women, because they may feel such pressure to be with a man, that they may not be asking the right questions.
You know, in the African-American community, there's so much pressure for women to be in relationships, whether they're good relationships or healthy relationships. A lot of women will meet a man and not ask him the right questions because he outwardly has everything she thinks is perfect. He will have a good job. He will drive the right car, go to the right church, and sometimes that's all it takes. So I tell women all the time, the next thing to do is to ask him, when was the last time he had an HIV test? And just don't buy the lip service. Make him show his results on paper from a clinic or from his doctor.
What has been the reaction to your book and to the lectures that you've been delivering? Are people, this is a lifestyle that you once lived. Are other people who are now still on the down low upset that you've made this public?
You know, you have those who show up at my lectures who want to talk about other things other than sexual behavior. They want to discuss the government conspiracy to kill off black people by planting the virus in our water and in our communities. Then you have churches who come and show up, and all they want to talk about is abomination. You're going straight to hell, the homosexuality, the only and greatest sin. And another group of people who feel that what I'm doing is an unjust and a disgrace to our community because I'm airing our dirty laundry and it's putting another black mark on black men. So what I have to do is try to get my people, number one, to understand that not all African-American men are on the down low. That you would have, hopefully, a majority of men who are comfortable in their heterosexual orientation but need to realize that this disease is having an impact on all of us. That number two, that this behavior, bisexuality, crosses all ethnic groups. And number three, that DL men do not purposely go out their way to infect their women. A lot of them don't know their status. That's why we have HIV National Day of Testing. That's why we have a big push with our social marketing messages of knowing your status.
What are public health departments doing about this?
We've been trying to get the word out there that this epidemic is no longer a white, gay, male disease, that the face of HIV and AIDS is black, brown, and female. However, whenever the reports come out, the numbers keep increasing. I've been told by my friends who work for the CDC and health departments that the CDC is no longer putting money into prevention messages. Instead, they're putting that money and channeling that money to help those who are already HIV positive so they will continue to get the medical treatment they need. Just recently, a good friend of mine just found out he was HIV positive, married with three kids. So now he has to tell his wife. He called me. He said, I don't want to tell her because if I tell her, then it's going to get out. I'm going to lose my membership with my fraternity. I'm active in my church. Then it's going to be all over the church. I'll probably lose the relationship with my children. I will lose my reputation. He didn't think about his wife or she could be infected. The only thing that came to his mind was protecting his own image because in the black community, if you are known to be on a DL or homosexual or gay, then you are more or less burned at the cross, for lack of a better phrase. Until we as a community get past the whole fear, until we get past the whole judgmental attitudes and the finger pointing, we will never win this battle.
J.L., thank you.
Thank you.
J.L. King is the author of On the Down Low. He spoke to us from Chicago. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.